Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll hear about the future of higher education in Ohio. Jay Fox will also speak with experts about SAT testing and new home trends. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Central Ohio is home to a diverse array of higher education institutions. We've got at least 18 serving the Columbus metropolitan area alone. Now, higher education is changing. And joining us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss those changes is Dr. Arthur Levine, who is the president of Brandeis University in Massachusetts. Welcome, sir.
It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
And a great honor to have you on the show as well. So let's jump right in. What are the biggest challenges facing higher education institutions today?
Just a few small challenges. The United States is moving from a national analog industrial economy to a global digital knowledge economy. And the consequences for higher education are dramatically changing demographics. Nowhere is this more true than Central Ohio. It's also a brand new economy we have to prepare students for. It's also a technological revolution, globalization, and political winds that are very difficult for higher education. Other than that, nothing's changed.
Well, come on now. Now, I graduated in 1991 from Ohio State before it had a V, and I was a humanities person. I had a degree, a BA in American history. So my question to you is there still a place for the humanities, or are we moving in the direction of industrial and technical training?
I think there not only is there room for the humanities, the liberal arts, but they're more essential now than they've ever been. However, we need to know the liberal arts are only successful when they, and the humanities, when they have one foot in the library, the accumulated knowledge of humanity, and one foot in the street. But when society changes in the way that I just described, profoundly, deeply, swiftly, unendingly, what happens is higher education loses traction with the street. And the humanities or any other subject are only useful when we reestablish that traction, when we're able to tie liberal arts into careers. That's what we've done at Brandeis.
I would certainly hope that learning how to communicate, learning how to comprehend what we read, and learning how to write without the assistance of AI will continue to be a part of the future. But, you know, as we know, online learning and AI has really changed the educational landscape. To what degree does that impact students and teachers?
What it's meant in every era is that we've needed to teach students the technologies that have newly developed and how to use them. It's essential for them to get jobs. But what it means at the same time is that the traditional liberal arts skills, the ones you just named, communication, problem solving, are essential. When I went to college, the computer language that I was taught was Fortran.
Yes, I remember.
Fortran went out of, right. There were still dinosaurs when I learned Fortran. But if we can teach students digital literacy and we can teach them communication and problem solving, they'll know what to do next to find the next language and learn it.
Does it matter whether they're learning from home or in the classroom?
For some, I think it does. I sent my kids to college in face-to-face learning. But for a lot of people, they don't have the time. They don't have the capacity to get to campus. And for them, online learning is really, really important. And we need to make that available to people. Traditional college students, 18 to 24, full-time, living on campus, are now less than 20% of all college students. So the end result is we desperately need online learning, and we need it to be good.
All right, I want to use a four-letter word that starts with F, so brace yourself. I'm going to spell it. F-U-N-D. Isn't that a terrible word? We all have to talk about money. So what are the funding challenges that colleges and universities face?
There are some huge funding challenges. One is the federal government's been cutting back grants at major universities, which is a terrible, terrible error, to the extent that those fundings of research have made it possible for the United States to reach the pinnacle that it's reached in the world. And it's not as if, with that money gone, that research won't be done. It's just other countries that'll supersede us. The other difficulties are, when one looks at the population and one looks at the income redistribution, which has come from the move to the digital knowledge economy, what we're finding is that a growing number of students can't afford to go to college.
Now, and is that impacting enrollment?
Demographics are impacting enrollment far more in Ohio, which is, you have a declining population in the state of Ohio, and you have 18 institutions right in the Columbus area. So the end result is that there's a lot of college and not enough people to fill all the classrooms.
What do you do as a university president in a situation like that? Do you look for consolidation opportunities?
That's one possibility. The other possibility, and what we've been recommending to college presidents, is plan for the future. What do your students need? For instance, at Brandeis, what we decided to do was reinvent the liberal arts, change the core, focus on the skills and knowledge students need for the future, create internships, create advising opportunities so students get two advisors, a career advisor, and an academic advisor, create a second transcript, which details the skills and knowledge that students have mastered during college. In essence, prepare students who are market ready and have the durable skills they'll need for life.
Most people, when they go to college with the understanding that they're going to learn a skill set and a certification that will make them employable. But in the past, it hasn't always guaranteed employment. Some institutions have instituted public-private partnerships with corporations so that you kind of know where you're going when you graduate before you graduate. Is that what you're doing at Brandeis? Are you coordinating internship opportunities?
We're doing the public-private partnerships, but we're going beyond that. Colleges and universities throughout history have always been practical. You go back to the Middle Ages, and these people studied the trivium and quadrivium of the ancient world. Why? To get a job. You go to Harvard. Harvard gets created in 1640, and what are they teaching? Latin, Greek, Hebrew, Syriac, Bible. Why are they teaching those things? Because it's the equivalent of a public policy school. They're training ministers to lead the colony. Always practical, and when it hasn't been practical, and when it hasn't connected with the job market, we've had the kinds of complaints that have been boiling up in the last few years.
So what
Brandeis is doing is we're reestablishing that link.
So our colleges, are they resistant to this change, or are they accepting, and do they look forward to it, or does that create academic tension with tenured professors?
It does create tenured professor problems. It does have institutions that realize there are problems and are being very slow to act. But I got to tell you, when I came to Brandeis, I told the faculty we had to do this together. What I described to you were only a portion of some very radical changes. 88% of the faculty voted for it. And the reason they voted for it is that we did it together.
So everybody's input and weigh-in was a part of that discussion, correct?
It was essential.
Okay. So how important is upper-level leadership, and does the Ted Carter resignation at Ohio State University put a permanent blemish on Ohio State, in your opinion?
No. One president doesn't put a permanent blemish on an institution. Things happen. People are human. The Ohio State University is one of America's great universities, and it'll be known for that. What it means is that change occurs only with leadership from the top. So it means it's very important who takes this job next and where that person leads Ohio State.
Ravi Belaconda is the first president that has been an internal candidate moved into that position, but he's also the first academic leader that they've had in years. Do you think he's going to make a difference?
I don't know him, and it's very much a matter of individuals. But I must admit that one of the advantages I had in coming to Brandeis is that I was an alum. I was the first alum in history to head Brandeis. And it gave me a huge advantage in working with faculty. It gave me a huge advantage in knowing the institution. So this may be a very wise appointment.
So in a sense, you are part of the fabric of the DNA of Brandeis. Is that fair?
It felt that way.
Well, it has been a pleasure talking with you. We've been talking with Dr. Arthur Levine, president of Brandeis University, about the future of higher education. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Last year, more than 100,000 students in Ohio took the SAT or PSAT test. The ACT test is more common in Ohio, with almost 94,000 students taking that test. These tests represent a turning point with an opportunity to help students stand out in a very competitive admissions landscape, perhaps even unlocking scholarship opportunities and maybe identifying strengths that support both college and career pathways. Even in an environment where many colleges are now test optional, students and families value having the choice to submit their scores as part of their application. Priscilla Rodriguez is the Senior Vice President of College Readiness Assessments at the College Board and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So, Priscilla, what's the difference between the ACT and the SAT test?
It's a great question. So I'm going to start with a few similarities to have. So both SAT and ACT are what are called college entrance exams, right? So there are tests that are used by colleges to assess students who are applying to ensure that students that they accept are set up to succeed on that campus. Both tests foundational reading, writing, and math skills that students learn in high school and that research shows are needed to be able to succeed and get started, you know, well on a college campus. So then there are some differences. I work for SAT, so I obviously have more familiarity with that, but some specific differences. As of 2 years ago, the SAT transitioned from a paper and pencil test with a little bubble sheet that we all probably took it with to digital testing. So students now take the SAT on a digital device, a laptop or tablet. They can do that in school or they can do that on a weekend morning. The test, because it's digital, is now considerably shorter. It's just over 2 hours long and it adapts. So as students take it, the questions kind of adapt to how they're doing. That's what allows the test to be shorter. On top of that, the SAT, it unlocks doors to scholarships. You mentioned that, but we have really strong relationships with scholarship partners who use how students do on the SAT to award scholarships. This is a huge opportunity. And then the last point of difference I would mention, and I want to really stress this one, is students' access to free practice for the test. So SAT is made by the organization I work for called College Board, and we are a nonprofit, mission-driven organization. And because of that, we have a commitment to making sure that all students have access to free practice so they can feel confident and prepared. And I'm happy to talk more about it if it's of interest, but we have kind of a ecosystem of resources that students can use to prepare for test day without requiring students to pay for anything.
All right. So the short answer to the question then would be, if you live in Ohio and you're applying to an Ohio school, you want to take both tests, correct?
We see a lot of students do that. We do see a lot of students do that. So I want to acknowledge that. Yeah, I would say from an SAT perspective, the test is shorter. It is digital, which is what today's students feel most comfortable on. The bubble sheets honestly scare them. They're not used to testing that way. And we have free access to practice. So students are set up to feel really comfortable with what they're going to see on test day.
I remember because I went to school in the dinosaur age, we used to go to Stanley Kaplan for PSAT and SAT preparation, and it cost our parents an arm and a leg. So hearing about free resources in today's world is exciting. What exactly are those free resources?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I also took the SAT a long time ago, and my family didn't have the resources to pay for practice. I remember knowing that my classmates were doing that and feeling like I was already at a disadvantage, right, because I didn't have access to that. And that wanting to get rid of that kind of inequity is exactly what's behind the now 10-year-old commitment we've had to free practice. So let me talk quickly about what students can do. The best way to prepare for the SAT is using free resources. So the first is on the College Board testing app that students will use on test day. It's called Blue Book. It can be downloaded by anybody at any time. We have 8 full-length official practice tests, all available for free. They're made by us, and they look at and are scored like the real SAT. When a student takes one of these practice tests, they get customized results back. What did they get right? What did they get wrong? Why? And they get suggestions for other questions to use to hone the skills that they're not as strong on. From there, they can go over to our partners at Khan Academy. They're another nonprofit, leaders in online learning resources. And their students can engage with videos, lessons, practice questions, and quizzes, focusing exactly on the skills that our practice test told them they most needed to focus on. And then the last part I want to mention is a new partnership for us. This is an expansion of what we offer with an organization called Schoolhouse.World. Schoolhouse matches students in peer-to-peer group SAT tutoring completely free, where they are tutored and learn together for about a month before an SAT, so that students who want that in-person kind of interactive practice and tutoring can get that too, again, completely free of charge.
Now, you said that when folks take this test, they can either take it during the school year, you know, during school hours, or on a weekend, and they are issued a laptop of some kind, an electronic device. How do you make sure that there's no hacking? You know, we've had such cybersecurity issues lately. How do we make sure that the testing is secure and fair?
Great question. So I'll start by saying that keeping SAT scores secure is our top priority. And to do that, when we made the decision to transition to digital testing, we built that app I mentioned, Blue Book, which is where students now take the PSATs, the SAT, and AP classes, those advanced placement classes offered in high school for college credit. All of those tests happen on Blue Book. Blue Book is the most secure testing platform in the world. Why is that? The first is because Blue Book, the app, completely locks down the student's device. They can't get out of the Blue Book app and access the internet, AI tools, messaging platforms, or any files they have stored. They're kind of stuck in Blue Book during the time of the test. The second layer we add to that is even though students are taking it digitally, they're not taking this at home. They are still gathering in rooms in schools with trained proctors. They're in the room to help them, of course, if they have any issues with technology or anything else, but obviously importantly to keep an eye on security. The third, and this is unique again to the SAT, is that before 2 years ago, students testing on the same day used to all get the same questions. And now with the digital test, what we can do is grab questions from our pool of thousands of questions that we have and scramble them up. so that every student is taking a different version of the SAT at the same time. There's no point in looking over at your neighbor's desk, chatting in the hallways during a break, or even going online to see what students have seen earlier that day. You're getting a unique set of questions that day to ensure that the work you do reflects what you've learned.
All right, so the school year is roughly over, and summertime is upon us, with testing not occurring again for some until the fall. Is the summertime a really good time to practice?
It's a great time, yeah. So we see many high school juniors take an SAT for the first time in the spring, so specifically March, April, May, or June. We and students then take a little bit of a break for the summer. We start testing again in August and throughout the fall. And so whether a student took their first one this spring or they haven't yet and they're planning to start in August or September, highly recommend they download the Blue Book student testing app. That, again, is where those 8 official full-length practice tests are. That's where they get the kind of personalized diagnostics and what kinds of questions to practice on. And that I also recommend they go over to Khan Academy and engage with official SAT practice there. That's where they can really refresh and build skills using videos and tutorials.
All right. So if someone is listening to this broadcast and they want more information and perhaps are not as savvy on their devices, what is the best source to get that information?
The single place I would send students or parents is sat.org. That is where you can see upcoming test dates, register for tests, access all of those free practice tools, and learn more about the partnerships we have to fuel free practice.
Couldn't be simpler. Priscilla Rodriguez, thanks for being with us. For Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
The 126th Inspired Home Show, which used to be known as the International Home and Housewares Show and North America's largest housewares trade show, that happened back in March in Chicago. And at the show, thousands of new products and innovations were unveiled, but only a few earned special recognition. The annual Global Innovation Awards celebrated the most creative and cutting-edge designs in the home and housewares industry. Inspired Home Show Media spokesperson Jane Klaus has been at the show, and she had a great time, and she's going to join us right now with some of the award-winning products that turned heads this year. Jane, I always love speaking to you because I know I'm going to have to go out and buy something when we're done.
Jay, you think you're going to have to buy something. You're going to have to buy some 3 or 4 things. In fact, you could buy 12 with all these winners. But yes, you will be interested and you're going to want to fill your house with all these great products, Jay.
So what makes the Global Innovation Award winner stand out? What do you have to do to be an award winner at that level?
Well, so first of all, I want to tell you that the GIA Awards, the Global Innovation Awards, they're like the Oscars of housewares. So they're recognizing all of the innovation across the industry. So it's all types of products. But here's the thing. These products combine brilliant innovation with real-life usability. We all want solutions to make our life better, go faster, and feel joy. So they check all the boxes: beautiful design, smart function, and a better way to do everyday tasks.
Okay, that being said, what are some of the products that caught your attention this year?
So I'm going to just kick things off because it's, you know, any day is a good day to talk about garlic. Jay, do you like good garlic?
You know I cook Italian all the time. So yeah, garlic's a part of my life.
I mean, more is more and less is a bore. And garlic can be really cumbersome to peel, and then you got to clean it. So we've got a really cool garlic press from DK Household Brands. You can press more garlic at once. And why is that? Because where the pressing area is just a larger space, and you don't need to peel it. It's stainless steel. It's quick and easy to clean. I have solved all of your Italian cooking problems, Jay.
and I'm going to make bolognese when I get off the air. So perfect timing.
Such great timing. And then another thing that we saw, or one of the winners, rechargeable indoor outdoor LED lantern. So how many times you're like, where's the light? Where's this? I just need this. It's right there. It's easy to touch. Indoor or outdoor, you can move it wherever you need. And again, like, it's just a clever solution to an everyday life issue that you think, oh, I would love to have more light in this area. Well, there it is. Buy three of those. Buy one for every room.
And closets, too.
And closets, too. What a great idea, Jay. Thank you. I'm going to put that in my notes.
So what else?
So are you always grabbing a water? I know you're doing radio, so you got to have a quick water nearby to wet your whistle every now and then. Well, to save you time, to save you money, we've got the ReePot water purifier for travel. Ooh. So you make this at home. Yep. And it's a beautiful glass bottle that you're going to make at home. You could fill it up. You know how many ounces you're drinking a day, but it's purified for travel. So it's a beautiful, sleek machine that you're going to have at home, and you can take it with you. It's got this advanced filtration technology, and it uses reverse osmosis. So I love this.
Now, does the filter have to be changed often?
That's a really good question. I think that you would just pop in a new filter daily because they're little sheets.
Oh, I get it.
You're going to put on the, yes, exactly. Like
okay.
A coffee filter.
Anything else new in the kitchen before we get to my questions from my cats?
Oh, your kitty cats. Okay, so I'll tell you in the kitchen, Jura, do you know Jura specialty coffee machines? Well, they've come out with their latest and greatest model. It's a C9, but this Jura coffee machine, it has got the ability to cook 35 different specialties from coffee to espresso. It goes from beans right to your cup. It is literally, it's a luxury coffee maker. Like, I wake up and I'm like, the fresh smell of coffee in the morning. I can't wait to have one. It is the ultimate indulgence. And side note, it is beautiful.
So you mean I don't have to wait in the drive-thru for a half an hour anymore?
You know what? I'm going to save you so much money. You do not have to wait in the drive-thru. You go bean to cup right into your cup, and on the way you go. I'm saving you money and time, Jay.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, Shadow and Antoinette wanted me to ask, what's new in kitty cat trends or pet trends in general?
I love the kitty cats. Well, I'll tell you, Paws Pick, I mean, they totally get it. They are a Geo Award winner. They have a battery-operated pet water fountain. I know that those kitty cats are standing on your kitchen counters or on your bathroom counters trying to drink out of the sink, yes?
Well, Shadow jumps in the bathtub, which is why we got him the stainless steel pet fountain. And then Antoinette decided she had to have her own, so now we have two.
Even better. Well, Paws Pick has got battery-operated pet water fountains, and they have a rechargeable battery. But the good news is they're ceramic, and they look absolutely gorgeous in all of your home decor. Jay, pet celebrations are on the rise. 36% of people that were surveyed for the International Housewares Association State of the Industry Survey said, I will attend Jay's kitty cat's birthday party. So pet celebrations, you're going to have a party just for your pet. So they've got treats. They've got multi-cookers, so you could cook fresh and healthy food for those cats.
I'm so doing that in July. That's outstanding.
You are so doing that.
I mean,
this is all you. I know.
Okay.
I'm excited for you.
I got to ask this question as
yes.
a millennial, and I'm not a millennial. I'm a Gen Xer, but how far away are we from the household of the Jetsons?
Innovation is always top of mind at the show. So everything is one touch, two touch, smartphones. It's connected to your phone. So you can be in the drive-through of the coffee shop and you could be making coffee at home. So I think we could be there sooner than we think, but do we really want to be there? Do we need more things to click on, or do we want to just get hands-on and do it ourselves, Jay?
I have a problem with the microwave talking to the toaster. It's disconcerting.
It's a little bit weird, right? But you know what? Let them talk, and then they won't bother you. They'll just do the work for you.
All right. So where can people find more information on these innovations? Because I know there's tons we didn't cover.
I mean, so many we didn't cover. Hundreds of thousands of products and innovations were on the show floor in March. It was really exciting. But, you know, continue to follow along with us on social media at The Inspired Home Show. We will be highlighting all of the products from the Geo Awards and the products that we saw on the floor and all the trends that will be on the store shelves and in your home, Jay, in the year to come.
You got it. I want to thank Jane Klaus. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
We start with the latest on the effort to abolish property taxes in Ohio. The grassroots group Committee to Abolish Ohio's Property Taxes, or Axe Ohio Tax, has been working to put a proposed constitutional amendment on the November ballot. The committee says it is on pace to gather enough signatures to make that happen. Organizers say 305,000 voters have signed the amendment petition to place it on the November ballot. They need more than 413,000 valid signatures by July 1st. They argue people are being taxed out of their homes, young people can't afford to buy a home, and politicians aren't doing enough to fix the problem. Committee member Brian Massey had this to say at the announcement, which he made while sitting in a replica Oval Office in Northeast Ohio.
Private property ownership is the foundation of freedom and liberty for all Ohioans. We no longer want to be just renters from the government. Home ownership in Ohio is merely an illusion. Any tax causing a citizen to become homeless is immoral.
Massey also read and signed symbolically what the group is calling a new Declaration of Independence for all Ohioans. It includes the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and private property ownership. Here's Massey with more of the committee's arguments for the proposed amendment to abolish property taxes.
We have come to realize that the property tax issue is more than a dollar and cent issue. Private property ownership is the foundation of freedom and liberty. It allows families to get out of poverty by allowing the transfer of wealth from one generation to the next. Without the right of private property ownership, we are merely serfs to the government. As our elected officials have refused to protect our inalienable property rights, we, the people of the great state of Ohio, are left with no alternative but to ourselves secure freedom and liberty for this and future generations by abolishing Ohio's immoral property taxes. Is it the role of government to be in the business of property valuation? We have third-party appraisers being paid by the taxpayers' money. They control the destiny of the taxpayers with their property valuation system, but they're not accountable to the taxpayers. Ladies and gentlemen, I submit that's what the Boston Tea Party was in 1773. There's nothing new. By getting the government out of the business of property valuation, we may discover that we do not need an auditor and a treasurer in every county. We're going to have to start a doge throughout the state of Ohio to determine how we can actually reduce the size of our government.
Now, the committee must submit the signatures to the Secretary of State's office by July 1st. They have a goal of collecting 620,000 to give themselves a buffer to meet that 413,000 goal in case that there are some that are thrown out. Meantime, a statewide coalition just launched a public education campaign opposing this amendment. Ohioans to Protect Public Services says this amendment would devastate public services and schools if passed and lead to very high sales and income taxes to replace the lost property tax revenue. State leaders say property taxes bring in $24 billion a year. Joining me now is Ohioans to Protect Public Services spokesperson and advisor, Kurt Steiner. Kurt, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Doug. Nice to be here.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, just who makes up the coalition?
Well, we have 65 members from all over the state that are very broad-based organizations, and from unions to businesses to local government groups to school groups to groups that represent the parks and libraries, people with disabilities, developmentally disabled people, children's services, senior citizens, mm-hmm. a very broad base.
How did it all come together?
It all came together because of this amendment that's being proposed and the idea behind it. And the idea behind it is to eliminate, abolish all property taxes, all of which are supporting local services. Every dollar in property taxes goes to local services. It doesn't go to the state of Ohio at all. And to get rid of all that revenue, which is two-thirds of the support for local services of all kinds, is just a near impossibility. And if it were done, it would require huge increases in income taxes, sales taxes, or massive cuts in the kind of services that we use all the time.
Why start the education campaign now?
Well, because the idea has been in circulation for a long time, and many of these groups have been opposed to this concept of total abolishment of property taxes. But the idea of putting them all together is to be able to speak with one voice mm-hmm. and from a very broad base and make sure that the information we provided is credible and informative to everybody.
Do you understand the committee to abolish Ohio's property taxes' frustration?
Absolutely. We all agree that something continues to be needs to be done with property taxes. The legislature has made some reforms. They're looking at more reforms. The system does need to be reformed. People are very frustrated with the rising property taxes, and they do want to see something done about it. But this is sort of like trying to figure out how to reduce electricity rates and like shutting off the power. That's not the way to do it.
Let's talk about townships in particular. It's kind of it's a unique form of municipal government. So how much would it impact a township if the property taxes were eliminated?
Well, there are 4.5 million Ohioans that live in townships. And of course, we all drive through townships all the time.
Right.
They rely almost exclusively on property taxes to pay for everything that they do, including maintaining their local roads and then all their police, fire, EMS, 911. All of that is paid for with property taxes.
And I heard that's like 97% of funding or something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. It's almost all of it. They do get some gas tax money for some of their roads, but and they get maybe some local government funds from the state. But bottom line is almost everything that they do is paid for by their locally voted property taxes.
You also make the argument that the lost revenue would have to be made up somewhere. So it would be shifted in some way. And that would most likely be through sales and income taxes. Does your group have an estimate on, you know, how much that might increase in order to make up the difference?
Absolutely. It looks like, and again, we base that information on information that came from the State Office of Budget and Management, but you're looking at a sales tax increase that maybe triple what it is now, so up toward 20%. Looking at an income tax increase, 15, 16%, we would have the highest sales and the highest income taxes in the country if the state was being asked to bail this out.
Now, the Committee to Abolish Ohio's Property Taxes argue that Ohio doesn't have a revenue problem, it has a spending problem, and that it would be up to lawmakers to cut the size of the government. You heard Brian Massey say that. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's kind of interesting because Mr. Massey and others complain about the growth in state spending, but then they take direct aim at local property taxes and local spending. So it really doesn't even address state spending in any way. So it's like they have a target, but they don't even shoot at the target they're talking about.
And I guess, do you, you know, like they've been, he even brings this up, that they're criticized that they don't have a plan to replace what they're talking about. He says that's up to lawmakers. Mm-hmm. Does your coalition have ideas? Are you putting forth anything, or is it right now, is it just
well, the only concept that's on the table is mm-hmm. this concept, which stops at just eliminating all property taxes. So the main thing that we are doing is just explaining what would happen if all property taxes, which is two-thirds of the support of all local services from police and fire protection, EMS and schools and other services, would go away.
But you mentioned you also support more reform.
Absolutely. We do support more reform, and we're watching closely what the General Assembly is looking at doing. And to me, it looks like they will do more.
I was going to ask if you expect more, because they came up with.
I can't speak for the General Assembly.
Sure,
I want you to know that. But you know, it looks to me like they're thinking about doing some more things.
Yeah, led by Representative David Thomas, they did pass a series of five bills that they say will save property owners more than $3 billion over the next 3 years.
Yes.
Does that give you some, you know, is that moving in the right direction for you? And do you think more needs to be done?
I think it's absolutely the right direction. One of the things that they've done that, you know, some of the groups aren't crazy about, but they've done it, is deal with property values. So as property values go up, your property taxes would also go up. But what they've done is they've said that in the future, property taxes that are unvoted can only go up by the inflation rate, not by the valuation rate. So somebody could have a 10% increase in their home value, but let's say over that period of time inflation was only 2%. That's all the higher their property taxes could go. So that's a really significant reform. That was one of the reasons why property taxes went up. There were also some trap doors that were in the system. That were causing some people to have this very unusual spiking. And Representative Thomas and others have dealt with that. And that those kind of spiking for those kind of reasons, for those complicated trap doors, have been eliminated.
The whole tax system is very complicated.
And it's hard for people to understand, and it's understandably hard to understand.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.